Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week on WLRN. The Securities and Exchange Commission is a government agency that can be confused for the College Athletic Conference that includes the University of Florida and shares the same acronym, SEC. No confusion necessary. The commission is the government's watchdog over the stock market. The name Dr. Philip Frost is best known for institutions that bear his name around the region. The Frost Science Museum, the Frost Art Museum at FIU, the Frost School of Music at the University of Miami. This month, the SEC accused Frost of stock fraud. In a statement Friday to WLRN, Frost said he was stunned by the charges and denies the allegations. He said they, quote, are belied by common sense, my history of supporting promising scientific technology, and the facts, end quote. Through a different spokesperson, he declined an invitation for an interview with WLRN. Back in July, we first spoke with the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Jay Clayton, when he visited Miami. You'll hear that conversation later on in this program. Before the charges were filed against Frost, we had a second interview with the SEC boss scheduled for last week. So we asked if the Securities and Exchange Commission chairman wanted to comment about the Frost accusations.
No, long-standing commission policy is not to comment on enforcement matters, and I'm not going to comment.
Now, you will hear that a lot from the chairman as we discuss what Frost is accused of doing. Frost is a billionaire who made his money in the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries. He's a dermatologist by training who has bought, built, and sold companies. It has brought him billions of dollars of wealth, and he has donated hundreds of millions of dollars to groups throughout South Florida. He still runs Opco Health, a publicly traded drug and diagnostic company headquartered on Biscayne Boulevard in Miami. The SEC accuses Frost of participating in a scheme manipulating the price of low-priced, thinly traded stocks. Nine others are charged along with Frost. They're accused of buying shares of three companies, touting their business prospects, and then selling when the stock prices went up. It's called a pump-and-dump scheme. Someone pumps up the stock price only to dump the shares when prices go higher. Frost says he remains a longtime investor in both companies included in the federal charges. The Securities and Exchange Commission claims Frost made at least $1 million in the trades. Together, the scheme allegedly made $27 million for those accused of taking part. When we spoke with the SEC chairman, Jay Clayton, last week, he did not want to comment on the specifics surrounding the charges against Frost, but he did talk about the type of stock trading Frost is accused of and the investigative role of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Clayton spoke to us from his office in Washington, D.C.
How prevalent is the type of scheme that Frost is accused of participating in the markets, this being the pump and dump scheme?
Again, I'm not going to make any comment related to a pending enforcement action, and I don't want to do that by association. What I will say is that pump and dump is a manipulation scheme that has been around about as long as markets have been around in different forms. It is something that I believe every investor should be aware of because it shows why regulation and why what we do here at the commission is important. When you have a manipulation scheme of this type, what you do is you often have a stock that is low priced and thinly traded. When a stock is low priced and thinly traded, it provides people with the opportunity to acquire a lot of that stock and move the price of that stock with not a lot of money. So if a stock isn't traded much, when you start buying it, you can raise the price. So if you acquire some of it and then start buying it publicly, sometimes in coordination with others to raise the price, that's the pump. You acquire a bunch of shares, you raise the price, say from pennies to $5, $6, $7, $8, and then you create a buzz around the stock. Hey, this is a great company to own. It's gone to $7. It's going to go to $12. It's going to keep going up. And then as others join, because they like seeing the price go up, others who are not part of the scheme come in and buy the stock. The people who are part of the scheme dump the stock. That's the dump. So they've acquired it for not very much money, pennies. They've managed to raise the price, and then they've gotten out at $6, $7, $8, and the people who now own the stock have purchased it at that price, and really the underlying fundamentals of the company have not changed.
Chairman, explain where the illegal action happens in that, because if an investor is successful, they may want to brag about how successful they are. Is that considered a pump?
What I want to do is outline the what I will say is the scheme. You're raising a very important issue, which is how do you differentiate between legitimate market activity and a scheme? And we try very hard to make sure that when we do bring actions or take action as a commission, that we're not adversely affecting legitimate market activity.
So what are some of the hallmark signs of a pump and dump that the Securities and Exchange Commission uses as it reviews those kinds of transactions to decipher between what may be illegal activity and what could be legitimate market activity?
I'll give you a stark example that the company actually doesn't do anything.
The publicly traded company has no assets, for instance, has no business activity.
Correct. Or no meaningful business activity, or no meaningful change in its business activity, despite increasing in value by a substantial amount.
What's the threat of these pump and dump schemes? You mentioned they are ages old. They certainly are. Here in the age of the internet, that information can travel a lot faster than in the printing press only days. But you're still talking about stocks that, as you mentioned, are thinly traded and maybe pennies on the dollar. These are probably not stocks in 401k plans, pension plans, mutual funds.
So people use the word confidence a lot. Confidence is critical in our marketplace. And to the extent people are doing things that would undermine confidence, it's important to deter them or stop them. We take so much for granted in this country. The fact that we have markets that provide reliable prices is an amazing thing. But if you have reliable prices, you can order your affairs for the long term. If you can order your affairs for the long term, you know, you do much better. If you look at countries that struggle, one of the hallmarks of them struggling is that they don't have reliable pricing systems. So people can't, they live day to day rather than living for the long term. One of the great things that our securities laws have provided people in this country is generally reliable prices.
Now, I know you won't address the specific charges against Dr. Frost and others that were filed earlier this month by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The company that he heads up, the publicly traded company that he heads up, OPCO Health, released a statement saying, quote, "The SEC failed to provide notice of its intent to sue prior to filing the complaint." Now, again, Chairman, I'm not going to ask you to address the specifics of the charges and the accusations against Dr. Frost, but does the SEC usually tell targets about possible charges before they're filed?
I'm not going to comment. It's not appropriate for me to comment. We have I talk about our regulatory system having prices in this country. One of the other great things in this country is we have due process. I'm not going to get involved in a pending enforcement action in any way. Everyone is due their due process.
Understood. And I think a lot of people certainly would agree with that. But I guess that statement from OPCO Health brings up the question about process, prior process for the Securities and Exchange Commission. So I'm just wondering, generally speaking, is there a practice that the commission has in engaging with a person of interest in these types of cases prior to charges being filed?
We have a number of policies and procedures in place, but I'm not going to comment on a specific one in this context.
Would one of those procedures be discussing potential charges?
Like I said, I'm not going to comment on specific procedures, but I can tell you that we have policies and procedures designed to ensure that we do things in an appropriate manner.
Would one of those policies and procedures be the process that OPCO Health describes?
Like I said, I'm not going to comment.
what is the message to investors, to entrepreneurs, to others who are directly involved in the markets, but also those who are involved in kind of the broader community of money and finance, the message of these types of charges that you've brought?
Again, I'm not going to comment on specific charges, but what I want to tell you about our enforcement program is that they have in mind our Main Street investors as they pursue their agenda. What they want to do is bring the types of matters, investigate the types of situations that people on the street would expect them to do. And I think that that's the right perspective.
An enforcement action like this.
And in particular, you know, they have been focused on, and I applaud them for this, they've been focused on matters that get people their money back.
Restitution.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it. I mean, restitution is a legal term, but what matters is, you know, what matters to the person on the street is if they've been ripped off, can we stop it and get them their money back?
To make those investors whole again, or at least partially whole.
To the extent we can, yes.
When an enforcement action involves a fairly well-known corporate executive, is that something that you would be made aware of prior to the action being taken?
I'm not gonna comment on our policies and procedures, but we handle matters, you know, the same regardless of who's involved. That's the right way to approach these things.
Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Jay Clayton speaking to us regarding the types of illegal trades the agency says Dr. Philip Frost conducted between 2013 and 2018. Frost is active in South Florida philanthropic and business groups. He sits on the board of directors of the holding company of Coconut Grove Bank and is a member of the advisory committee of MBF Healthcare, the private equity firm run by fellow billionaire Mike Fernandez. In an email to WLRN, Fernandez wrote, quote, "Unlike the current White House agenda, everyone is innocent until proven otherwise," end quote. Still to come, more of our conversation with the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And could the stock regulator upend almost a century of practice, the mandatory quarterly corporate financial report?
Are we managing our corporations for the long term? Are we investing for the long term in plant, property, equipment, and human capital?
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. President Trump has used his Twitter feed to attack, shame, and congratulate companies with varying degrees of truthfulness. 2 years ago, he tweeted that he was canceling a deal for Boeing to build a new Air Force One plane for $4 billion. That was the price tag for two planes. This summer, Boeing finalized a deal for two Air Force One jumbo jets for a combined $3.9 billion. In August, Ford announced it would not ship one of its models built in China to the United States. The reason was the new trade tariffs the Trump administration has put in place with China. A week ago, President Trump tweeted, quote, "This car can now be built in the USA and Ford will pay no tariffs." Ford is not moving production from China to the United States. It says it would not be profitable to build this particular model, the Ford Active, in America because sales here are so low. Business is not spared the president's Twitter feed. So it got some attention last month when President Trump announced on Twitter he had asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to study the idea of ending a long-standing requirement for publicly traded companies filing financial reports every 90 days. President Trump's tweet quoted a business leader, whom we later learned was the CEO of Pepsi, as saying, "Stop quarterly earnings and go to a six-month system." Now, for decades, publicly traded companies in America have had to publicly release their financial results four times a year, every quarter. Shifting away from that schedule is something the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission says it already had been studying before President Trump sent out his tweet. We spoke about the issue with the SEC chairman, Jay Clayton, last week. He spoke to us from his office in Washington.
I think the president touched on an issue that is in the minds of many market participants. And that issue is Are we managing our corporations for the long term? Are we investing for the long term in plant, property, equipment, and human capital?
But who do you mean by we, Chairman?
I mean we as an economy. You know, we have an amazing economy. We have a $19-20 trillion economy. We, the U.S., has 62 of the world's top 100 companies. We have 4.4% of the world population. You know, think about that. It's amazing. But what do we have to do? What have we done in the past, and what do we have to do in the future to maintain that preeminence in terms of, productivity, ingenuity, investing for the future? These are really important questions, and I think everyone recognizes that, you need long-term investing and long-term thinking as part of that economic mix.
Is less frequency to financial reporting part of that?
How a corporation manages itself, how it reports to its shareholders, how it makes these decisions, there's no one lever that affects that. It's many things together.
Sure.
How is your board structured? What is your engagement with shareholders? What is your engagement with the street through quarterly
sure.
reporting?
But one of those cornerstones, right, has been quarterly reports. Every 90 days, a financial report that is submitted to the Securities and Exchange Commission becomes a legal document. That has been part of the expectation for investors and stakeholders for the better part of three generations now, almost.
Absolutely, probably longer than that. Transparency is the hallmark of our capital markets. Good financial data, strong auditing, and transparency have been critical since 1934.
That was the act that created the Securities and Exchange Commission out of the ashes of the Great Depression. Were you given a heads up that the president was going to be sending out this kind of communication?
This has been a thing that's been talked about by a lot of people for a long time. So, it's an issue that actually let me tell you this, which is very interesting. It's an issue we've been looking at here for a number of months, and to
even
give
before
you,
the presidential tweet.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, because you have a particular requirement doesn't mean people aren't going to report quarterly. For example, there are a number of regulatory regimes in Europe where quarterly reporting is not required, but most large companies report quarterly. One of the questions that I'll say is on my mind is, quarterly reporting is ingrained in, sort of the American capital markets, but is it appropriate for smaller companies? Do you really want smaller companies that are in their growth stage to have to report quarterly? That's a legitimate question.
In the last 20 years, the number of publicly traded companies has been cut in half. Do you think the requirement of financial report every 90 days has played a role in that?
So I'm going to take your question and make it broader, which is, do I think that the regulatory regime that applies to public companies, or that you would subject yourself to as you become a public company, has played a role in it? Yes, I do. Do I think it's a significant factor in some cases? Do I think it's a predominant factor? Maybe yes, maybe no. Other factors include the availability of capital in the private markets. Substantially greater availability of private capital today than 20 years ago.
Certainly, there's been large macroeconomic trends that have influenced public and private capital. But when you think about that regulatory environment that you speak about, certainly as it relates to small companies, young companies, companies that are still in a growth trajectory, the financial disclosure for those companies that are in the public markets, for those investors, could be even that much more vitally important because of the volatility of their financials, couldn't it?
It very well could be. It very well could be. And, you know, look, that is part of the kind of questions we should be asking ourselves. If you are an emerging company that's growing, you're growing from a company that may have a size of 100 or 200 million in terms of, equity market cap to a billion or two, the kind of growing companies you want in your economy, you're going to ask yourself, do I want to go to the public capital markets where the regulatory regime is more rigorous? And as you mentioned, something that you deal with on at least a quarterly, if not more often, basis? Or would you get your capital in the private markets where, you know, you're talking to, you know, three or four lead investors who have a great deal of influence over your company, but may have a longer term or different view on how you report to them? I like that companies have that choice. I want to make sure that we're calibrating that choice in the right way for companies and for our investors. That's our job here at the Commission, is to look across the public and private markets and make sure we're calibrating them correctly, always, always remembering investor protection, and that investors are counting on us to craft rules that appropriately protect them.
Chairman, how have you communicated back to the White House after the president mentioned this and kind of charged the Securities and Exchange Commission with looking into this, something you say you were already doing?
Yeah, I put out a public statement on this that basically said, we're looking at this. We're looking at this as part of a broader package of whether we have the appropriate regulatory structure. And I expect this debate to continue.
What's the process for investors to expect as the Securities and Exchange Commission reviews and considers the quarterly financial earnings filing requirement?
We identify issues, and then we have a number of paths we can go. One that I'm considering here in this area is kind of having roundtables where we get different industry participants and investors to come in and talk about the issue. We have some standing committees, including our Investor Advisory Committee, which is meeting next week, who can take up these issues. And that's a way for us to get feedback from a number of perspectives as to whether, you know, we have this issue right. Then if, we think something needs to be done from a rulemaking perspective, we would have a rule proposal that the public would have an opportunity to comment on, and that's how we would take it forward. So right now we're at the early stages where we've been looking at it internally, gathering internal information. I expect we'll see some kinds of roundtables around this, and then we'll take it from there as to whether something should be done.
Our conversation with Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Jay Clayton. The process he describes there to study if the practice of requiring quarterly financial reports from public companies is similar to the path the agency has used for a different proposal. This one would affect the relationship between investors and some of those who help them decide how to invest. That's still to come with our conversation with the chairman of the SEC, Jay Clayton, next.
When you ask somebody, how much of my money is going to work for me, and they can't give you a straight answer, you should not use that person.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening to WLRN. Today, we're featuring our conversation with the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Jay Clayton. We actually spoke to him twice, once in July while he was visiting Miami, and again last week. He heads up one of the agencies that sets rules for how investors and people they rely on for financial advice interact. As with a lot of things in the world of finance, it gets complex about the different types of advice from people with different types of titles. Financial advisor, spelled O-R or E-R, broker-dealer, all of them may offer ideas to investors about what to do with their money. But there may be differences in how they get paid and what drives their recommendations. Registered investment advisors are banned from putting their financial interests ahead of investors. Someone who is a broker does not necessarily have that obligation. The SEC wants to hold brokers to the same standard, something it calls best interest.
You have to put the client, you have to make recommendations to the client that reflect the client's interest. That's where we're going with this.
Has there been a rash of bad actors to lead to this effort on the part of the commission?
Unfortunately, we see more retail fraud and more retail practices that are inconsistent with what we expect than we would like. And we see it in both the broker-dealer space and in the investment advisor space. One of my objectives is by bringing clarity to this space, empowering consumers to ask the questions that will minimize the risk of being subject to those bad actors. I mean, when you ask somebody, how much of my money is going to work for me, and they can't give you a straight answer, you should not use that person.
That was the SEC Chairman Jay Clayton when we spoke in July. When we caught up with him again last week, we asked for an example of the kind of practice he thinks the proposed best interest rule would stop.
High-pressure, product-specific sales contests are inconsistent with regulation best interest.
But would they be banned outright?
I would expect that what we will see in the final rule is that that kind of high pressure, hey, here is a particular product. If you sell it, you are going to make more money type of activity is something that I would expect we will say is inconsistent with the rule.
Let me also ask you about fee disclosures as it relates to this best interest regulation that you and the staff at the Securities and Exchange Commission are working on. Some of the changes proposed could affect how brokers communicate the future impact of sales fees and marketing fees and other kinds of fees that especially mutual fund investors pay. How does the Securities and Exchange Commission view the effort toward more individual disclosure of the impact of investment fees on an investor's portfolio?
I expect that fee disclosure will be better and more individualized as a result of this rulemaking.
Could there be a knock-on effect to the half of American households that hold some kind of investment position in stocks, most notably through either pension funds or 401k or 403b kind of plans?
In a short answer, yes. When you have greater transparency, you have greater fee competition, and that has inured to the benefit of individual investors.
The effort by the Securities and Exchange Commission to bring more transparency to financial advice comes as the percentage of American households owning stock has dropped to just over half, and the biggest drop has been among the youngest potential investors, those between 18 and 29 years old. At the same time, surveys have found younger potential investors are more attracted to virtual currencies than the stock market. So, still to come, the newest thing in investment markets, cryptocurrencies.
I'm not going to change the way we're doing things in response to a new technology.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting WLRN. Earlier this year, there was no more hotter investment than Bitcoin. The cryptocurrency market was coming out of the shadows and emerging as a new sector for traders and investors. Between last September and January of this year, the price of Bitcoin skyrocketed 500% to almost $20,000 per Bitcoin. Since then, its price has fallen by two-thirds. Bitcoin is the largest of a group of cryptocurrencies with names like Ethereum, Ripple, XRP, and Tether. These are currencies, but not like the dollar bills in your bank account. They are virtual currencies that exist only in computers. They are not issued by a government. There's no bank, but a digital ledger basically a database that records transactions. We did a program about Bitcoin in South Florida back in 2014. You can find a link to that on our Twitter feed at WLRN. South Florida has become a bit of a hub for virtual currencies. The international business profile, entrepreneurial spirit, and fast money culture have helped the crypto popularity here. There are several dozen Bitcoin ATMs and companies that accept payment in virtual currencies. Cryptocurrencies are borderless, anonymous, and digital. As much as that appeals to some, it also presents challenges for regulators like the Securities and Exchange Commission, especially since there is nothing really stopping anyone from creating a cryptocurrency. And here's where the agency is getting involved. It used to be a small company would grow and attract investors by selling off slices of ownership to those investors. Then, if the company was successful enough, it could sell stock to the public through an initial public offering, an IPO. As the nation's investment watchdog, the Securities and Exchange Commission has specific rules governing what a company has to do when it sells stock to the public. That stock, by the way, is called a security, thus the name of the agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission. The exchange part refers to the public trading on stock exchanges. But companies are issuing their own cryptocurrencies called tokens, representing ownership of something. It may be products the company makes or part of the company itself. When a business does this, it's called an initial coin offering, an ICO. Companies have raised more than $18 billion this year from doing this, according to CoinSchedule, a British company that tracks the market. That's triple what it raised in all of last year, and the Securities and Exchange Commission is watching. In June, it appointed its first crypto czar to watch over this fast-growing business. We spoke about the burgeoning business of virtual currencies and South Florida's role in it with SEC Chairman Jay Clayton this summer when he visited the agency's Miami office in Brickell.
What we're talking about are digital assets, and there are different types of digital assets or crypto assets. There are crypto assets of the type that is Bitcoin, where there's no venture behind the asset. When you buy a Bitcoin, you're simply buying a medium of exchange, or investing in a medium of exchange. That's different from a crypto asset where, say, you come to me and say, Jay, I'm starting a venture here in Miami, and I want you to invest in my token or crypto asset. I'm going to take your money, and I'm going to, let's just say, start a real estate business. That's a security.
So those would be called, I think, in the vernacular, initial coin offerings, ICOs. Those you see as securities, but the cryptocurrencies themselves are not in that definition. Is that correct?
I think that's a fair way to characterize it. Now, there are some people who may call, in an effort to avoid securities regulation, may call what is an initial coin offering or an offering of equity or other security a cryptocurrency. Just because you call it a cryptocurrency doesn't mean it's not a security. I mean, it is... We look at substance in the securities laws, and we've been looking at substance in the securities laws since 1934. And you know, if you're offering an interest in a venture, you're most likely offering a security.
And so, with that in mind, you've seen a rash of good actors and bad actors, like any type of investment opportunity. The attraction of ICOs on the part of small companies has been an effort to raise capital in a relatively frictionless environment. How do you, and how does the agency see this growing effort by small companies to raise capital in this environment through these tokens, through these initial coin offerings?
So, taking a step back again, I'm all for, and the people at the commission are all for, helping companies raise money. Now, let's go to the frictions. We have two long-standing models for raising money. If you're going to do it in a private placement, the frictions are less. You have to know something about the quality of the investor you're dealing with in terms of sophistication, the qualities of the investor you're dealing with in terms of sophistication. But by and large, if you do a private placement, the frictions are relatively minimal. If you're going to do a public offering, we at the commission have a investor protection and market protection mandate. There are frictions. You have to have audited financial statements. You have to, you know, file disclosures with us. You have to take certain responsibilities for those disclosures. What I like to say is we've built a $19 trillion economy following one of those two models. What some people in the ICO space want is they want the low friction of the private placement market with the high penetration secondary trading, broad reach of the public markets. We found out in the 20s that was a bad idea. Other economies that have followed us have found out that that's a bad idea. I'm not going to change the way we're doing things in response to a new technology.
For a community like Miami, which is internationally focused and one that is dominated by small and medium-sized businesses, the ICO market specifically and cryptocurrencies generally have been seen as real opportunities. The broader community here has identified cryptocurrencies as a place that maybe Miami can help distinguish itself as a intersection of the United States and Latin America specifically. So as the chief regulator when it comes to securities in the United States, how should a community, a global community, a community in Miami that sits at the crossroads between the United States and Latin America and capital, and we see a lot of foreign capital come through, some of that through the cryptocurrency world, how should this community be thinking about cryptocurrency and initial coin offerings as it relates to the legal framework that you're responsible for putting together and maintaining?
So we're sitting here, I'm looking out at Miami and have remarked many times that I was here in 2009, and the resilience of the Miami economy is astonishing. The way capital moves, the way labor moves, the quality of the labor force here. And guess what? All of that happened without an ICO. Now, that said, I think Miami is a great place for capital formation. It seems to have all the ingredients to become a place where ventures do well, where we have small companies that turn into larger companies and larger companies that support newer, smaller companies. What we want to make sure is that this new technology, distributed ledger technology, is used for good and not for fraud. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of fraud in the ICO market. I think we're striking the right balance.
The agency recently appointed a crypto czar. What are the responsibilities of this position going forward?
I would say she has many responsibilities. The principal one is to make sure that we are coordinated in exactly what I was alluding to, our balanced approach to distributed ledger technology. There has been a great deal of fraud. It's our job to deter that. It's our job to remedy it. There's also great promise here. Distributed ledger technology has the ability to eliminate frictions in our system. Eliminate frictions without lessening investor protection across the commission, across our various divisions. We're coordinating to achieve both those objectives.
Speaking with the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Jay Clayton, during a visit to Miami in July. Still to come, how the stock market watchdog has changed since two big investment scandals, including one costing thousands of Floridians millions of dollars.
We need to continue to be vigilant and think of additional ways to use technology and use our requirements to reduce the risk of a Bernie Madoff.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. This past weekend marked the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The investment bank went bankrupt under a mountain of bad debt and after the federal government refused to give it a lifeline. Its collapse plunged the banking industry into chaos and helped push the economy, which already was shrinking, deeper into recession. The drop in stock prices 10 years ago also exposed what was a decades-long scam, Bernie Madoff. He admitted ripping off hundreds of people for billions of dollars in a far-reaching Ponzi scheme. Almost one in every five people scammed lived in Florida, most in South Florida. Madoff skirted regulators for years and left the Securities and Exchange Commission with a black eye for ignoring warnings. In July, we asked the current Securities and Exchange Commission chairman, Jay Clayton, about those past investment scandals and how active the agency is in policing the nation's markets for investors.
Have we addressed some of the issues that would have made it easier to detect a Madoff-type situation, including issues around custody and asset tracing and the like? Yes, we have. Doesn't mean that we're able to catch every fraudster. And we need to continue to be vigilant and think of additional ways to use technology and use our requirements to reduce the risk of a Bernie Madoff. That's our job. That's what we come to work today. You know, we came to work today, we come to work tomorrow thinking about that.
You don't have to have that great of a long-term memory to remember some of the failures on the part of regulators when it comes to the capital markets. I'm thinking specifically of WorldCom and Enron from 15, 16, 17 years ago. The blind spots that the securities regulators had when it comes to those cases, have those been addressed in your estimation as you've come into the agency in the last year?
So look, I'm gonna start with a bit of a defense of the agency and detecting. What you're asking about is detecting accounting fraud. Do we have procedures in place today that are different from then in terms of ability to detect accounting fraud? Yes. Do we have safeguards in the forms of requirements like an independent audit committee and a majority independent directors for most companies? Yes. But we need to be ever vigilant around things like accounting fraud. It has been with us. I don't expect that we've cured it, but we need to remain vigilant.
As you work with the legislative body, with Congress, do you have the resources in order to address those growing concerns and frankly, the growing risks that not only the previous frauds present, but also the new types of markets that we spoke about earlier, the initial coin offerings and tokens and cryptocurrencies, those types of products offer?
So our greatest asset at the SEC is our people. We have good people. We have between 4,500 and 4,600 people working across our home office and then our 11 regional offices. There's no substitute for good people. I think we have sufficient resources to do our job well, but to the extent that we can recruit additional good people to the SEC, we're always looking to do that.
But do you have the resources to do that?
Our budget now is sufficient to do our job, but if I identify areas where we can use more money to do our job better, I look forward to having a dialogue with Congress on that.
Let me ask you about enforcement. The first half of this fiscal year has seen the number of enforcement actions taken against public companies drop precipitously compared to a year ago and is at a five-year low by one study from New York University. Do you see that same change in enforcement actions on public companies?
Well, it's funny that you asked that because I was just talking to our staff here in Miami, and I don't consider 6 months or a year to be a meaningful trend in virtually anything dealing with the markets. We have not changed our approach to enforcement. My philosophy on enforcement is to hire very good enforcement attorneys and have them go about their business. My overall direction is to bring cases that have impact, and in particular, impact on the people who need us most, which are the, you know, over 50% of American households who are invested in the markets.
Does that mean a focus, a real concentration on enforcement when it comes to investment brokers, investment advisors, as opposed to the issuers of securities, public companies specifically?
No, it does not. But it does mean focusing on the cases that are going to have an impact for retail investors. Let me be clear. If there is fraud, accounting fraud, you know, other types of fraud at a public company, whoever is behind that needs to be out of our system. End of story. One of the things that is important to me is focusing on individual accountability. I think you'll see if you look behind the cases that have been brought in the near term, you'll see a greater amount of focus on individual accountability. In fact, we just reached some settlements on the eve of trial where I would not have supported the settlements unless they had sufficient individual accountability.
So when you talk about the characteristics of enforcement that will have impact on retail investors, the 51% of American households that own stock, own equity, what are some of those characteristics that you look for in those kinds of enforcement actions?
Well, let's look at both people that run public companies and people who are investment professionals. The people who run public companies have a fiduciary duty to their investors. The people who are investment professionals have a fiduciary duty to their clients. We want to bring cases that demonstrate that you need to follow those fiduciary duties. Those are the kind of cases that have impact. When someone is sitting at their desk and says, you know, how do I behave today? We want them to know that they have to behave in a way consistent with their fiduciary duties.
The Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Jay Clayton speaking with us from the agency's Miami regional office back in July. Now, earlier this month, the agency filed charges against Miami billionaire philanthropist and biotech CEO Philip Frost, accusing him of stock fraud. Frost denies the allegations. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at WLRN. Also look for a podcast of this program by searching Sunshine Economy on iTunes. Pilar Ribe is our technical director. We had production assistance this week from WMFE in Orlando. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.